Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's great. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
To this special edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Along with me tonight is Christopher Buns and Mr. A.J. Houston. We decided to kick off Black History Month early. We decided to kick it off because today everyone's celebrating Dr. King's birthday, and we look at it, or the Martin Luther King holiday, I guess I should say. And we decided that Black History Month should not be just 29 days or 28 days. We decided that we wanted to start it off early. So tonight we're going to tell you, I guess, how we view who Dr. King was and what he meant to us, his legacy. And there's a lot of facts that we found out about Dr. King that I didn't even know until I did the research, y'all. Learned a lot of stuff that I thought I knew, about Dr. King, and then I found out that he was really a very, very smart man who did a lot in his very short life. So tonight, Mr. A.J. Houston and Christopher Bonds are on deck. Good evening, guys. How y'all doing?
What's up, Chris? What's up, Carrie? Y'all doing all right?
I'm good.
Hey, A.J.
Listen, y'all, A.J., did you hear Christopher? He said good evening.
Yes, how you doing? great.
Well, listen, y'all, you know, it's the Dr. King holiday today, and, you know, I did my research on Dr. King, and I know y'all did, and I found out some very interesting things about him, and there's a lot of speeches out there that I listened to, and he was just a phenomenal man, and I absolutely believe that he is probably the greatest leader that we've had in the last century. Would y'all agree with that?
Well, I'd say one of them for sure.
Really? One of them? Really? Yeah. I think why I say he's the greatest. What'd you say, Christopher?
I think he's one of the greatest.
Okay. I think why I say the greatest, because the sacrifice that he made, and we're going to play that mountaintop, just a snippet of that mountaintop speech that he did in just a little bit. But I think he was probably the only leader that we've had in this last 100 years that was willing to give it all up, you know, for what he felt was his calling. And I don't think I've seen another leader be willing to do that. So I guess that's why I considered him the greatest leader. Which
well,
I agree with.
I have to add, see, a lot of people have him and Malcolm mixed up because they were friends.
Okay.
And see, Malcolm and Martin had agreed that they were looking, they were searching for the same, I guess, objective, but going about it different ways. Because many people mistake Malcolm saying by any means necessary and that we need to arm ourselves as though he was arming for instead of retaliation, he was arming for an offense. He was arming because of all the problems in our community, and the police were continually beating and brutalizing people. So he was saying, we're going to defend ourselves. So Malcolm got a bad rap, but I'll say I think both of them gave up for the same thing. But I do adore Dorson Martin for sure.
Thanks. And what about you, Christopher?
Well, you know what? I'm agreeing with AJ in terms of how Malcolm X actually, he sacrificed a lot of things too. And if you look at them both parallel, you'll kind of find out that anyone who decides that they're going to basically sacrifice, put themselves on the line, and look at it from that perspective, they sacrifice their families too. I mean, they love their families, they love their wives, they love their children, but when you're spending that kind of time pushing towards civil rights and change, your family sacrifices too. And so kind of like at the end of the day, both of them gave up a whole lot being away from their families. And then near the end of their lives where they both knew that it was a high likelihood because of the death threats, they even walked through that and decided that if that's what was going to happen, that's what was going to happen. Now, a lot of other people probably would have started to recant, back down, back away under the threat of their life. But they knew that that was a big possibility, but they continued forward. But I think that Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King was one of the greatest leaders, black leaders of our time.
I absolutely agree.
Can we choose a different starting point?
Sure. I'm sorry. AJ had a starting point. I apologize. Yes, AJ.
I wanted to choose a starting point because, you know, and even if we Malcolm is included, but we're just going to talk about Martin today. But
okay.
See, the thing is most of the leaders didn't start out in that particular capacity. It wasn't their goal or their choice.
Okay.
Because a lot of times leaders aren't chosen. They are birthed. They came with it. Because Martin thought he was just getting a pastoral job at a church. And he saw some wrongs, and he talked about the wrongs, and everybody started coming in because they had never heard anybody speak the way he spoke in the language that he was speaking that was a communicative language of joining people together. He wasn't just talking about what needed to be done. He had solutions in his words. He had solutions in his voice. So they started putting him out front. And then out front, you didn't go to be the leader. It was just that they wanted you to speak. So now everywhere you go, you're speaking. So now people are writing you letters, and they're saying, hey, we got a problem over here in Peoria. We got a problem over here in, you know, other parts of Georgia. We got a problem over here in Mississippi. And he's like, well, okay. So that was the beginning to where he saw his niche, his fit. He saw where he fit. So I don't think he started out saying, I give my life for this. I think he started out saying that somebody need to fight. And sometimes when you say somebody need to fight, you say who? You say me. And you say, wait, not me, right? Like a Moses concept.
Hey,
so,
you know, so, you're probably right. I agree. So you want us to start right there?
Yeah, start in at the beginning, you know, because when he first went to the church, he was just a young preacher that nobody wanted there because they liked the old preacher that was there.
Okay. We start there. And, you know, the thing is, if, you know, and we can start there, but if we were to go all the way back, let's go back to the fact that his name wasn't even originally Martin Luther King Jr., right? His name was actually Michael King. And so was his father. And at some point, his father changed his name. And then because Michael was a junior, he had to change Michael to Martin, too. So that's when they both became Martin Luther King. And I'm trying to find my notes on that. And it was because his father had gone to Germany, and which I just found this odd. I guess it's true, but I just found it odd that black people were changing their names way back then. But his father had taken a trip to Germany, from what I understand, and for some reason after, and I'm looking for my notes, I apologize, but after the trip to Germany, he decided to change not only his name, but Michael Jr.'s name, and they both became Martin Luther King. So isn't that interesting that he would do that that early
wow.
on?
Well, you have to look at the other Martin Luther.
It was?
I said the other Martin Luther.
Yes, right, because of the other. Oh, here it goes. I did find my notes. I apologize. Dr. King's name was originally Michael, not Martin. His father also Michael King, hence why Martin Luther King Jr. originally changed, originally named Martin. I mean Michael King Jr., and it seems like his father took a trip to Germany in 1931, and he changed his name in homage of a historic German theologian by the name of Martin Luther. And so Martin Luther King, as we know him, Dr. King, was then too. So he changed his name then to Martin Luther King Jr., and that's how he became, as we know him, Martin Luther King, Jr. I never knew that.
Wow.
I never knew.
All right, so Carrie. All right, Carrie, getting some information. All right.
Hold on, baby. You know what, whatever.
I didn't know that either. That's interesting.
Listen, if we're going to do history, y'all, we're going to do history right here on Center Stage. So we're going to begin by telling you who he really was originally. But there were so many other different things about him that I thought was interesting in terms of how smart he was. This man was no joke. I mean, he obviously, you know, was someone who, as far as school was concerned, enjoyed academics and really excelled, you know, even from a youngster. So obviously people saw stuff in him from a very early age. Dr. King skipped 2 grades, y'all. In high school, he skipped the 9th and the 11th and entered Morehouse College at age 15. Who does that? And that was in 1944. And by 19, he had received his bachelor's degree in sociology. This guy was smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, as I was thinking about, you know, that, I think sometimes when you're a leader, it's in you from the beginning. It just takes the right people or the right environment to nurture it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so I believe,
yeah.
Yeah, you agree that maybe he was groomed because he had the right people around him. You know, he had a preaching family and that type of thing, and obviously some other great influences in his life. But I think he was a born leader.
But I think that's what I said in the beginning. Most leaders are birthed.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm saying, agreeing with you completely. But the same thing is, see, when Martin went to the church that he went to, they was getting rid, they liked the old pastor, but they was getting rid of him because he was a radical.
Yeah.
And they wanted this young man, this young smart man, to come in because he had this great, he was a great orator, and they liked his message. But they had no clue that the man they got rid of wasn't even compared to the man that just received.
Really? I guess, when you go to some place like what I'm understanding about him being in, he went to, a seminary school? And
yeah, theological
do you
seminary.
Know that Dr. King, of all people, got a C in public speaking? I see.
Well, that goes to show that the teachers, you know, like, I guess the message is always those that can't teach. You know, when you go to school, you have other aspirations. You have other things you want to do. But some people want to be teachers. But some people go out and try and do something else first, and then they fall back on a teaching gig because it pays. And those people have animosity toward other people. So I'm quite sure him being a young man, having the ability of writing and speech that he does, they wanted to change him for him to be kind of like them instead of be like him.
Yeah, and that's true, and I believe that. And even though, don't they say most teachers teach one way as opposed to teaching how the student can learn? You know what I mean? So if you don't fit into a box, then, you know, automatically, you know, they just, I don't know, assume that you're not teachable or that, you know, you shouldn't qualify for a higher grade because they don't know how to teach you, basically because I don't know why somebody is texting me while I'm on the air, but anyway, I'm going to shut my phone off because for some reason I keep being text. But anyway, that said, it appears that this particular instructor obviously didn't know what he had, and Dr. King was like an incredible student after that, and I don't know, it was because no one seemed to know in this research why it was that particular teacher gave him or that instructor gave him that C. But Dr. King later went on to prove himself and actually excelled and became like a leader in his class. And so it just seems like I said from the beginning, and I'm agreeing with you, AJ, he was a born leader, and obviously, you know, sometimes, but don't in most cases of great leaders, it's always somebody initially along their young life that tries to discourage them or doesn't see the greatness within them?
But if there's no struggle, there's no progress.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. That's good. Christopher, what do you think?
When you are what you are and you try and be, you know, everybody, because I'm saying, this is not the same, but I was at Kansas State, and I gave this teacher all my poetry. And he, when I got it back, it was like I turned in a paper in his class. It had red marks all over it. You know, you can't write like this. You can't say this. You need to say this like this. So I actually tried to change my way of writing, but it didn't feel like me.
Did you?
And I think it was that discovery process that I understand what you're saying, but all these writers that we read wrote different ways, so how can you try and make me be something that I'm not? But it comes to, it's a self-realization that you have to come to. So I think that was his arena of self-realization, that they said that you are just an average student when it comes to speaking. But he's like, no, I've been speaking for a minute, so I think I'm above average, but you have to challenge yourself beyond what everybody around you say is worthy or what you can do or what you're about in order to become who you're supposed to be.
It says that basically by his final year in seminary, he was a straight-A student. He was also a valedictorian of his class and the student body president. So does that show you that teacher had him wrong? I mean, really. That,
well,
but that's just amazing.
It shows me that the teacher challenged him to exceed beyond the teacher's capacity to think of him.
And two, on that, in terms of the teachers and the instructors, you have to have individuals that will actually attempt to foster that. When you talk in the 40s and the 50s, integration had not even happened. So the black individuals that did go to predominantly white schools, they already had one or two strikes against them because, first of all, in a lot of cases, they didn't want them there. Then a lot of the teachers probably didn't even know how to encourage that black student. But AJ is right. I think in this case, though, that once Dr. King knew he could probably exceed the standards and excel, and he did, he was able to prove that instructor wrong. But then again, too, I'm looking at the fact that at the time that he was in school, it's not like he was probably in a classroom of he was later on, but, I mean, in terms of when at the early schooling, if you were not going to not an integrated school, but a black individual going to a predominantly white school, you probably, it may be everything from learning how to conduct yourself to the testing that goes on in those schools, but when you are a bright student, it's very hard to stop that individual's limitlessness in terms of being successful. I think they're going to find a way because I think they're going to put into it to be able to excel and work hard at doing that.
Well, I think a way of rephrasing that in simple terms, like when the first standardized test came out, there were questions like a cup and a saucer and, you know, these type of things that African-American families don't usually use, or that's not the terminology that they use. So there was tests with terminology that wasn't standard for us that they called a standardized test. So when you start going through the process and saying, this person failed because he didn't know the standard terms that we use, not the terms that they use. So that was the problem. A lot of times we're graded on a whole different level as far as what we're supposed to know, although we know what it is they're telling us. They just phrase it differently and use different words that we've never heard to make it seem like we don't know.
Okay. And I agree with that. And, you know, the thing is, I think when he was in school too, sometime though, and I'm sure we've all come across this at one time or another, if you are a smart black person, we'll just put it that way, a lot of times certain people, especially if they're not of your race, are very intimidated. Can we agree with that?
Who are you telling? Who are you telling? I know. I know. I was always in trouble. This is not a joke. I was always in trouble, and I wasn't bad. I was just smart and didn't know I was smart because if nobody tell you, you know, I guess we're still talking about Martin, but in the first and second grade, I was never in my class. I was in all the other classes sitting in front of the class reading books that they were reading because I went to school able to read when I was three. I was reading to the class, and I thought that was normal. So you start thinking things are normal. If nobody tells you it's not, you wouldn't know the difference.
And I think sometimes when people are insecure and they come across someone who is above, you know, what their norm is, they can become easily intimidated. And so maybe, because nobody could explain why he got the C. You know, everybody said he'd been a great speaker, you know, forever. His dad thought he was one of the greatest speakers he had ever seen. So it's just amazing that the instructor didn't see it that way. But, like, again, you know, there's no history.
Could have been the language you used.
Huh?
Could have been the language you used. They want them to use different language.
This is true. This is true. It could have been many reasons. But, like I said, the history does not indicate, you know, why that was. And like I said earlier, y'all, you know, we're just going to talk about who he was to us and some of the great things that we found out about him. Some are funny even. You know, we're not throwing no bones on Dr. King tonight, so if you think that the trivia is going to include any of the dirt, we're not going that route tonight. But we're going to talk about some of the other things. Some are funny, some are very serious. But we just want to talk about, you know, Dr. King in a way that maybe somebody else isn't talking about it, because everybody's talking about Dr. King tonight. One thing that I found that was funny was that Dr. King and Coretta spent their honeymoon in a funeral home. I didn't know that. And that they call it a funeral parlor. And that was because not that somebody died, but because his friend owned the funeral parlor, and he offered it to them to use for their honeymoon. I'd never heard that before.
I've never heard that before.
And I'm just trying to figure out how did he talk Coretta into going there with him. But that's just another story. That's just crazy. But it must have been one dude at a funeral.
No, really, I'm saying it's funny to us, but at a time when you need a space where you can have a gathering of people, and you have to reel back in the time. There weren't places that would rent dance halls to African Americans.
Yeah.
So it was just a place, and probably other people that had things there too.
But
he was willing to give it to him, you know.
Maybe, and yeah, I don't know. I feel like you're right. That may have been a situation in which he couldn't just go to a comfort inn and check in and just, you know, I don't know. But because he wasn't famous then when he
was
he famous?
Back door time, Terry.
Say what?
That was still back door time, going through the back door. You got to come to the back entrance, all your food at the back.
Yeah.
Well, but you know what, too? I didn't know that fact, but there probably were certain things that were common that may seem strange to us now because of the accessibility of not being able to just go to. And then what town were they in? Because it may be in some more larger metropolitan areas, there may have been black-owned hotels or this or that, but in smaller areas, you probably had to make do with what you could get.
True. And, you know, another thing I found out about him, I knew he had been arrested a couple times. I just didn't know Dr. King had been arrested 17 times, and Coretta Scott King had been arrested 18 times. So they was in it to win it, y'all. They was down for the cause.
Wow.
That's a lot of times. But that's what I found out in research, that he had been arrested 17 times, and she had been arrested 18 times. So they really obviously believed in the movement.
And see, on that note, you have to know that there were more than them being arrested because they were in groups. So the group had to be funded so they could actually pay bail for the people because they knew they were going to get arrested.
That's true. Because back then, if you did a boycott or you did a march, you was going to jail. Somebody was going to jail.
Yeah.
And there were several marches. Yeah, I came up with the fact that they did like the Selma, Alabama march, which was about voting rights, and that was like from March 7th to March 25th in 1965. You know, he also led the Montgomery march, which was about, you know, the boycott on the bus system because Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. There was also that Memphis sanitation, that was the last one, that was March 18th, 1968. But in 67, May 25th, in fact, of 67, he marched in Chicago about Vietnam. So he was really out there, you know, putting a lot of wear and tear on some shoes for the cause. And so don't you all ever wonder how African-American people went from being so motivated and ready for change and ready to go, be jailed or, in some cases, have dogs sicked on them or have hoses turned on them, you know, all to fight for what they felt was right. Do you feel like we've lost a lot of ground in 50 years?
But, Terry, the thing is nobody notices because when they, just like when the slaves were freed, the only place they knew was the plantation.
Yeah.
So they left and came back because that's the only place they knew. So we are the same. We have the same embedded in our DNA. So when we thought we had reached that level that he said we wanted to be at, that was our level of satisfaction. We couldn't see past the dream.
But he told you in the speech the mountaintop. You know, I've seen the mountain. All right, and when I may not get there with you, I've been to the mountaintop, and you know, I've seen over it, and you know, we may not get there together, but what I took from that was, you know, we got ahead. And we stayed ahead. I didn't think we were going to get ahead and then start going backwards. I don't think that was a dream. And so I'm trying to understand as a people, why haven't most of us realized that the dream is slipping away? You know.
Well, it stopped participating in the process. See what it was? The process changed. We didn't. Just didn't change with the process. See, because what I got from that is that that was the same thing that happened to Moses. Moses didn't say it because Moses went to the mountaintop and got the scrolls, got the Ten Commandments. And he didn't make it to the promised land. He didn't make it to the promised land with him. You know, he stayed outside. So Martin was saying the same thing, like, I have these commandments that I was given to give to y'all. So I'm not going to make it with y'all, but I'm sure we're going to get to where we can get to together. Because he knew at some point in time, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me. It's not going to be
with him
all the
days of life. The days was getting very short at that point.
All the days of my life. That's what it says. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. So to me, that was the same Moses. That was the same thing that happened to Moses, but that was the speech. That's what he saw. That was the dream. That was the mountaintop. That was the plateau that he saw, that I can get this. We can reach these things, but I may not make it with you, but I will give you the blueprint to get there.
And see, as he was sensing whatever he was sensing, they said that Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech painted an even bigger target on his back than before, not just with certain people in general, in the general public, but with the FBI. And the FBI circulated a memo about Dr. King, and basically what it said was, in light of King's powerful demagogic speech yesterday, he stands head and shoulders over all Negro leaders put together when it comes to influencing great masses of Negroes. We must mark him now, if we have not done so before, as the most dangerous Negro of the future in this nation from the standpoint of communism, the Negro, and national security. So was he sensing that was coming based on everything that was going on around him? It sounds like, I mean, maybe he was just speaking prophetically and he didn't even know it, but or was he sensing this from, you know, what was happening day to day?
I think
he was getting so many calls and so much hate mail that, you know, you're getting hate mail from your own people and other people because they say you start in trouble.
Well, too, you know what, at that time, I heard some stuff and I looked up some stuff about President Johnson at the time. Actually, LBJ was very cordial and very accommodating to the everything that I think that Dr. King had was saying and doing at that time, even with the protests, the garbage workers protests and boycott, the bus boycott. What happened is that when he made that second speech that was in direct conflict with the Vietnam War, at that point it's documented that President Johnson, he kind of flipped his lid. And that's when he really opened the door for the even increased amount of wiretapping and basically spying. And at that point, I believe the tables were turned, and it was, I think that Dr. King was sensing that, but he also knew that that relationship that he had once had with President Johnson wasn't there anymore, because Johnson actually authorized a lot of things that he hadn't allowed against King, but then he did that second speech on Vietnam.
Well, and the reason being, when he did the speech on Vietnam, see, before he was this neighborhood leader, he was leading, gathering all the Negroes, getting all these people together for a common goal. But when he made the speech about the Vietnam War, if you remember, they were there were marches, there were all these people, peace, and, you know, all the hippies, and everybody was trying to stop the war. So when Martin made that speech, all those people turned around and began to agree with Martin. So he was no longer just a neighborhood leader or a one cultural leader. He was a leader of the people. And that was the change in him. That was the change of his followers and the change of the color of the people that was following him, because they saw that he was fighting for the rights of all people. Up until that point, they didn't see that. So
true.
When that changed, it was like he's more dangerous now than he's ever been, because now he got all the hippies and all the other people that's trying to stop the war with us. I didn't know Martin was against the war, because everybody had a problem with him. Like, man, don't talk about the war. We got enough problems on us about all these other things we're doing.
That's true. He was able to galvanize. You're right, AJ. He was able to galvanize people. And then, too, as long as he was just doing the neighborhood watch or we need to protest a little bit, they're not treating us right, fair wages, they were okay with that. But then he actually started to go visit a lot of the Harvards and the Yales and so forth, kind of like Malcolm X did. And he started talking to students, and then students were like, oh, yeah, where do you need us to be at? For when they were trying to do the get the folks registered for the and get the voting bill passed and stuff, and they had droves of white students coming out, and that's right, they started to galvanize them. And pretty much at that point, yeah, he became a real threat, because now it was crossing over into other things, and that mixture created the perfect storm to have some control over public policy. And as long as it's in your own neighborhood, fine. But now you're talking about public policy, state, federal public policy, international. Oh, no, we can't have that.
Wow.
And one thing I want to add about the I Have a Dream speech is, you know, I actually was paid to perform in President Obama's first inaugural address, and I wrote this long – they wanted me to write a poem, but I wrote this long kind of speech poem, and I did some studies, and I found there were two black guys. They wanted to go, you know, they were off, and they say, I just want to go be there. I just want to be a part of it. So they was going to go volunteer. So they went to the march in Washington. They found the people that said, okay, we want to volunteer. They sent one guy over at one gate, and they sent one guy over at the stage. So the guy that was at the stage happened to be at the stage right before Martin came on, and he was standing at the stage when after Martin read his speech. So he asked Martin, he said, can I have that seat? Can I have your notes? So Martin gave him his notes. But when he looked at the notes, there was nothing on the notes as far as the I Have a Dream speech, because that was the speech that he gave in Detroit. You know, and he wouldn't have went to I Have a Dream until Mahalia Jackson was sitting on the stage, and she'd say, Martin, tell him about the dream. Tell him about the dream, Martin. So that's when he folded up his notes, and he went on to his sermon, because his speech writers and everybody told him, hey, this is not the place for the I Have a Dream. You know, we don't need that. That's what we did at churches. You know, you don't need to do that here. That won't fit this amount of people. So if it wasn't for Mahalia and his drive to understand that it was time for him to tell everybody about the dream, that still wouldn't be something that we're saying today, and all the students are learning, and everybody's mimicking the speech and stealing parts of the speech. Because Mahalia told him, tell him about the dream, Martin, tell him about the dream. Because she had just blew the stage up singing. So
I would play that speech, and it's about 17 minutes long, though. That's too long, but unless somebody's got it. You got a shorter snippet of it, AJ?
No, you can't find a show when not even in students doing it. This is the whole thing.
Well, what did you write? Can you tell us what that piece was that you wrote about it, that you wrote?
Yeah. Let me find it for you. I'll find it for you. It's definitely a... And I was just, and the trip was is I wrote it. See, the funny thing, me growing up, me and my brother, you know, my father always told me I was so smart, I must have been raised by white people.
Uh-oh.
You know, so when president, and my father had passed, and I knew that he would have got a kick out of seeing the first black president.
So my
problem was, when President Obama was elected, my first thought was, you know, instead of saying he must have been raised by white people, was that he was raised by white people. So it was like my dad had told me this as a joke all my life, but now I see it in reality that this man was raised by white people. So it was, I'm saying, it hit me like a ton of bricks at the time. I was like, man, that is, you know, I always thought it was a joke and my dad was being funny. But I guess in his day and time, for you to be smart, you had to be have some affiliation or some dealings with white people in order for them to consider you, you know, even smart, just like we were talking about King at 15, you know, while he was getting seized. But I'm finna find this piece for you right quick, and I will.
Well, then while you're doing that, I'm gonna go to this. Were you saying something, Christopher?
I was just gonna say that in terms of one of the facts that I didn't know is in 1948, while Dr. Martin Luther King was at the Crozier Seminary theology school.
Mm-hmm.
I think in 1948, Mahatma Gandhi had been assassinated, and shortly thereafter, a few months, there was a professor in his school that was actually speaking on some of the principles of Mahatma Gandhi, and that was, I think, some of his greater exposure and why he took on a lot of the principles and philosophies of Gandhi at that point. So I had always wondered at what point did he get exposed to it, and apparently that was a significant time frame that he actually got exposed to the teachings of Gandhi.
Wow. And I'm glad you found that, because I knew he followed his teachings, but I didn't know how it came about. But that's good to know. Do y'all want me to just run a little snippet here of that speech about I've been to the mountaintop? To me, for some reason, that would just – I tear up every time he gets to the end of that, because it was as though it was like he was telling people, but did the audience even know that, you know, what he was saying was just too real? That's what I'm going to go to now, that speech about I've been to the mountaintop. Let me find that. And I just found it like, wow, he said that. What did it feel like to be in the room with him that night and then later find out just how prophetic what he said was? Let me see if I can go to that speech. But that was just absolutely tears me up. When I see him get to the point when he walks away from the podium, it's almost as though he's so full he just decides to just end it right there. And so, you know, for y'all who haven't heard that last 2 minutes and 38 seconds of that, that's what I'm about to go to. Okay, y'all, here we go. Y'all ready?
Yeah, ready.
Give me 1 second. And I'm going to cue it up. Okay, here we go.
True to what you said on paper. I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country. Maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they have committed themselves to that, over that. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say, we aren't going to let any dog or water hose this turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficulties ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. To live a long life, longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over
I think that part, I just tear up every time I hear him say that. I mean, what must it have felt like to be
in the glory, huh?
Yes. I mean, what must it have felt like, though, to be in the room? I mean, and you know, knowing that you heard him give that speech and then later to see what happened.
I think that was the most frightening part for all of the men that was right beside him, because they heard what came out, but they only saw later what happened. And when you put them both together, it's a frightening thing to say that I said I was going to draw this roadmap, not knowing where the roadmap was going to lead. I'm just trying to go where I'm led.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they saw that, you know, there was something really that he died for, and that was like, hey, I don't know. He said he might not get there, and he didn't. So I don't know if I want to say I might not get there. You know, a lot of times you start thinking about what you're going to say, so I want to say the same thing he said so I have the same results. But I did find the piece that you was asking me about.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, and it's Inaugural Address 2009. I'm not going to read the opening paragraph, but it says, I wish someone could tell me what it felt like after the March on Washington, when Dr. King's speechwriters told him not to do the I Have a Dream speech because he had preached it too many times in church pulpits. I would ask, how does it feel to know after the fact its impact and long-lasting effect on the world's population? It is so true. Sometimes knowledge clouds our ability to reach the place deep inside all those who are waiting, needing to be inspired by truth. I know how it feels to walk with champions. As a child amongst a crowd of thousands, Muhammad Ali spent much of the time in the crowd of people talking with me. Back in the times of capture, in the days of slavery, we had a list of demands written under our skin, hidden in the left ventricle of heart valves. This list has been passed down to generation after generation in secret genetic codes in the language of our father's father, a language we are no longer able to speak. So today I will translate it for you. Stretch yourself so you can be the best you can be. Teach those needing to be taught. Lead in ways you leave no one behind. Always show reverence to our elders, for they are the angels of guidance for the next generation. Speak clearly. Always say something worth listening to. And never forget where you came from. This list of lessons was ours before. Before that we came from kings, before the It Takes a Village, before the deception, and long before one-way trips on ships named Jesus of Lubbock, Lord, Adelaide, Armistead, Cora, and the Henrietta Marie. Before the forefathers of the country carved three-fifths into the pages of our Constitution. Never forget where you came from. I wonder if young Christus knew he aided in this day from his actions long ago, or Benjamin Banneker secretly knew one day the place he surveyed would be ran by someone who looked just like him. Don't ask why grown men, both young and old, cry tears at the mere acceptance of speeches. Some truths are not meant to be heard, only felt. We must understand those words sacrificed by fathers, mothers, grandfathers, and grandmothers at a time when we were too young to understand or too hard-headed to listen remain with us to this day. It says, my grandmother used to tell me, Jeffrey, change is going to come. It won't be by invitation, so be prepared, stand at the ready, and brace for impact because change is going to come. I know somewhere in this vast cosmos she is looking down at us right now, and she knows I listened, I heard, and today I see what change looked like. Out of all the lessons I've learned from my father, what appears most prevalent is my father watched as I passed and held up a fire to my lips and placed almost empty can by my feet with no words. He put his arms gently around my shoulders, and we walked silent, which seemed to be equivalent to two eternities. We stopped some 50 feet where we started, no hard words passed, no vulgarities. He stood and we stood face to face with rows and rows of tombstones. Most of these people I knew and grew up with. Some were smart in school. They all had potential, had plans, goals, purpose. And now look, they're lying on their back with rocks on their chest. He stood there for a short forever and no more words and walked away. I stood there attempting to do the only thing I could, reading the words carved into stone the family members could afford. Beloved mother of three, beloved father, beautiful daughter gone too soon, son loved and killed by drunk driver. I listened to the silence, hoping to hear some utterance of next, hoping the blades of grass kneeling, forcing the winds to speak, could spill some unspoken, unfulfilled purpose I could grab hold on to. or some aromatic smell of blossoming flowers could heighten my sense of direction, enable me to find my own destiny. But most of all, I understood, no matter what I previously believed time to be, it is limited. Hearing loud and clear every in and out of breath, now I know for sure I am here.
Mm.
Those I speak of are gone. I wish they were here to witness. We all have a long list of contributors in our life that are not alive today. They told us long before now that change was coming. Please believe this. There is still much work to do. The beginning of this process is up to the we. It's up to the we, it's up to me, it's up to you. We can't just tell our children to keep dreaming, but they don't know what to dream for. Keep teaching, but don't know how to teach more. Arms extended, but never learning how to reach more. This ground is unwarped. You already hold the key to the door. Keep faith, keep the fight, but know exactly what you're fighting for. We stand on the constitutional foundation that all men are created free. So if anyone here should forget the way to their purpose, to their destiny, just follow your feet, forward only. Our past laid the bricks on which we stand, made of bone and rock and tears and pain and the blood of countless men. To get to where you need to be, the path that holds your destiny. Just follow your feet, forward only.
I like that.
Wow. I like that too.
I like that. And so this poem was written for what occasion?
Well, it was a the inaugural address. You know, they had all these different occasions. So when President Obama was doing his inaugural speech on his first election, there was this formal event in Houston that I was invited to speak at. So I wrote this and I read it at the formal. And I'm saying, you had men in black. I'm saying, everybody's in tuxes and bow ties and looking sharp and all the women looking nice, formal dinner. And they invited this poet up. So I'm trying to figure out, I need to say something worth listening to. So that's what I wrote. You know, there's a little more to it, but it was just amazing that you had all these men sitting here crying because we never thought we'd see somebody that looked like us with their hand raised saying that, you know, I vow and honor to serve this country, to be the commander-in-chief of this great nation. And it was just such a historical event.
It really was. And, you know, and seeing that we have a black president now and Dr. King saying that, you know, he had been to the mountaintop and he'd seen the promised land. Why is it that even though we have, it doesn't feel like we've reached the promised land? I mean, and we can't put everything on President Barack Obama because, you know, he's not Jesus. We get that. But why did we feel like if we ever got to this point, everything was going to be okay, only to get here and realize having a black president did not solve all our problems?
Because I think we thought we participated in the process long before now.
Okay.
See, people vote for a president. They don't vote for the elected officials, the justice of the peace and the sheriff and all the other things that they need to vote for and the school board. So we leave out the process and just, you know, look at the higher goal. So to have a black president with nobody below him to agree or participate in his in what he's shooting for, we have a Congress and a government the way we have today where we've been non-participative in the process, so nothing's been done in Congress or in the House.
What were you saying, Christopher?
Something that AJ, he has a lot of wisdom, and he says key words that I key in on, and the one thing that he talks about is I believe it's absolutely true that the process has changed, but what happens a lot of times people in the black community, they tend to, we're all happy, and we had the honeymoon period, and the president's in there, and then they're like, well, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year. Doesn't really seem like anything, you know, there's no magic dust falling. Things are not changing as progressively fast as we thought it would with a black president. But people forget the process. Okay, you vote that person in, but then you have to hold them accountable. But then there's some things that you have to continue to do in your own community, individually and collectively, to keep things going forward. People kind of thought that was their savior. And so now I don't have to really protest. I don't have to write letters to my aldermen, to the senators and congressmen, and
and pursue or encourage or demand. And a lot of people got away from that. I mean, when things used to happen, even when Black America could vote in who they wanted in, they didn't let up off of them. Like President Kennedy, Black folks voted for him, but they were on him, too, about civil rights, about things, fairness, fair wages and stuff. So I think AJ hit it on the head when he talked about the process. We want to vote people in, but then we just think, like Lucky Charms, they're just supposed to do what's in our best interest. If we don't hold their feet to the fire, let them know what we want while they're campaigning, and then also after they get in, then hold them accountable. The process is a little different, but I think people are not, by and large, following the process, and that's why the leadership really doesn't feel like they have to really do anything.
I agree.
I agree.
You know, yesterday I did a Martin Luther King program at Greater St. Stephen's Baptist Church in Fort Worth. And when I started out, I had the whole audience to repeat after me, and I just told them, I say, if we believe it takes a village, then we are the village we've been hiding from ourselves.
Hmm. Ooh. That's true. And you know what? And the thing is, and I agree with that. What happened? I mean, what? How could we? Let me. One of those marches, y'all, really, really, really took me back because I hadn't seen this in my lifetime. That Montgomery boycott of the bus system. Do y'all know that thing went on for a little over a year? Can you imagine Black folks not on the bus for over a year? We're not disciplined enough not to get on it for a week.
No, that's
what
they said. They estimated
not to shop at Walmart.
Now they estimated the march would last a month. So they said we can last a month. But when it went over a month, they started calling Dr. King and everybody in, okay, we're going to give you this. They were trying to make concessions and not give them what they was asking for. But that was when they held out. See, that was when he found the resolve and the reserve to be the leader that he was meant to be, because that everybody, two different sides that say, hey, man, we've been walking long enough, man. Go on and accept what they're giving us. They ain't going to give us no more. And everybody else saying, it's up to you what you're going to do. It's I know we can get what we're trying to get. So that was the deciding factor in being a leader and not being a leader, when you decide that, look, we're going to have to hold out because I know we can get what we're asking for. But it didn't look like that at first.
Well, too, on that same note, I didn't know, but then looking up some of the facts, in 1955 for the Alabama bus boycott, King was really not well known. And the reason his name came up during the Black individuals and the white leadership in Alabama, and they said, hey, let's get that King guy over here. He tends to be bipartisan. He'll come in here and just kind of throw a few trinkets. He'll get the people to agree to the concessions, and that'll be that. But then you're right. Then when he got there, that was like that first leg up of leadership. And then he was like, wait a minute. They're giving you guys a little bit extra this, an extra chicken wing, but y'all asked for a chicken. You didn't ask for a chicken wing. So then he knew they had to hold out. And he convinced the people, and then he showed them how to do it. See, sometimes in the church, they say, don't do this, don't do that, but then they don't give alternatives. What King did is that he said, hey, look, this means that if you have to give that brother a ride, you have to loan that brother $5, you have to bring this sister, that brother in and give them something to eat, we must do this. That's the village ticket. You hurt, I hurt, I feel better, you feel better. But nobody's going to come in here and just offer a few things, because some of the Black folks wanted to take it now. They did. But he convinced them beyond that, and I think that was for the greater good, because that's kind of what had been happening before. Well, not really, because, you know, a lot of times the Black city workers basically just dealt with it. But this was one time they had the city over a barrel, and they were going to make the city give them everything.
And you know, and I agree. I think a lot of times we forget that, you know, companies like Google and Facebook, they sit down and they have grassroots meetings where everybody chimes in and tells what they think. And a lot of times they'll sit around that table and say, listen, there are no dumb statements or dumb questions. You know, whatever, you know, you have on your heart or whatever, say it. Because they realize some of the best ideas are birthed from just having those meetings where people just sit down and brainstorm together. And I think that's what we've stopped doing as in the black community. I think we stand on the porch and on the corner and we still be brainstorming, but we are not coming together as a people like they did back then and having meetings at the church, you know, where well, you can't do that anymore because the church is a corporation, so the government is not going to allow it, unfortunately. But back in the day, they'd meet at the church. And there would be a packed house where they would sit down and talk about what was going on in the community and how they were going to fix it. And they brought in leaders like Dr. King to help walk them through the process. Where are those meetings at today?
Well, they have some, Gary. They still have some.
Where
they have some. It's just not a lot of people going. They have a neighborhood forum at the Dot Bookshop in Fort Worth. What is it, every Tuesday?
Okay.
They're still marching against downtown Fort Worth, against some things that's going on, marching against City Hall. There's a lot of stuff going on, grassroots, but it's out there. The information's out there. But if you don't have the video of the little kitty or the funny video of the guy can't sing that has 18 million hits, they're not looking at it. You know, and I just told you a little bit, like a friend of mine just came out with a new CD. So I listen to the CD. You know, everybody send me a link. I go to the link and see what the video is, see what the story is, because a lot of people are posting positive stuff. But if you look, there's only 3 clicks on there. There's only 3 clicks. And you go to, you see the cat has 18 million, and everybody want to see what everybody else is looking at instead of seeing what they need to be about.
Yeah.
So we've lost our place. We want to join the group instead of be the individual.
There you go. I think it comes down to the sweat equity. And accountability, but also ownership. I often say that. Let me give you this. This is on my mind in terms of Dr. Martin Luther King and civil rights and some of the things that people had to.
Did we lose you, Christopher? Christopher.
Yeah, I think so.
His line is still open. Christopher. I don't know. Let me, Christopher, I'm going to close your line and then I'm going to open it back up and see if that helps. Okay, let me try opening him back up. Christopher, are you with us? He is driving, y'all. Christopher is such a trooper and a soldier. Christopher, with his bad self, he's hung up. He's going to dial back in. Christopher, with his bad self, y'all, not only is he one of the nicest people I've ever known, Christopher drove 600 miles one way to help a young lady out today. And Christopher is en route back to where he's supposed to be tonight, driving another 600 miles back. So Christopher is truly a trooper. And so did we lose you for a minute, Christopher?
Yes, I think it was someone coming through going back into Texas. So my call dropped, but I was able to get it picked back up.
Okay. And you were telling us what?
In reference to the civil rights movement, and in terms of what we were just talking about in some of the churches coming together like the churches of old used to and how it takes a village to raise a child and multiple organizations and individuals were involved in that, and they undergirded and supported. I was just thinking about some of the pictures that I saw at the museum when the police individuals that were peacefully protesting, when they turned the fire hoses on them. Has anybody ever sat in a jacuzzi and felt that water, the bead of water, that the port that pushes the water out?
Oh, that stream that flow that with all that pressure to it. Yes.
Yes, and if they turn it up just a little bit, how it becomes uncomfortable. I mean, can you now? So the reason I said that is there's some people that endured that time and time again. The pressure from a fire hose can rip skin off of bone.
Wow.
And it can fracture. It can break bones.
Mm.
It can disfigure. So I said all that to say, could you imagine in today's time, if you put somebody in there and you turned it up a little bit and said, now, we're going to go protest against Walmart. Now, the police may turn the hoses on you, real fire hoses. So we just want to give you a small snippet of what you may encounter. How many people do you think would be out there?
Today, none.
Today, none. So what I'm saying is that what I think in the final month of Dr. King and great leaders, that basically they had pushed the envelope to the point of no return. Once you get to the point, both physically, emotionally, and spiritually, where you have accepted the responsibility that you have to go down that road, it's kind of like Jesus saying, Lord, do I really have to do this, you know? But I said all that to say is that when you reach that point, you become very impactful as a human being. In other words, you transcend your mindset to know that, hey, I may get killed.
Yeah.
Someone may do me harm unto death. But once you realize that and you accept that, not to say that that may always happen, but you become even 20 times more dangerous than just somebody who's running their mouth saying, this is just an unfair. Because, see, now there's nothing that they can tempt you with. They can't take you in the back room and say, hey, you know, Bonds, hey, man, we're going to give you $5 million. You just snatch and you say, nope, if it ain't all for the people, if it's not for unilateral equality, no dice. So, see, a lot of leaders, I won't name some, but I think we know, have been bought and paid for. Dr. King died with a 15-year-old car. He died with a mortgage on his home. He didn't have a lot of money. The $58,000 he got from the Nobel Peace Prize, even against the advice of his wife, he gave it all away.
Yeah, he did do that.
He made the best choices, but he was ready and knew that if it took death, let's bring it on.
But Chris, one thing I want to add to that, I'm in complete agreement with you. One thing I want to add is that a lot of times when you understand that you've been speaking for a minute, but now you understand you have listeners, so you have to really, it matters what you say, and it matters how you say it. So now you're no longer saying the things that you thought you wanted to say. You're saying all the things that needed to be said. And there's a great difference in that. And it matters when you hear what listening sounds like. It's amazing. It's frightening. It's enlightening. I'm saying it's invigorating. Because I know, man, when you hear people listening, it's like, wow, I can't get up here and just say anything.
That's true. Very true.
I think what happens is we've gone into an era where everybody's about me. And so when something happens to me, I want everybody to show up and support me. But when something happens to somebody else, or if the cause does not directly affect you in your household, you don't show up. And I think that's the difference.
Also, we're always waiting for somebody else to do it.
We see something that
need to be done, and we're always waiting for them. Ooh, look at that. That trash needs to be picked up in my yard. I hope my neighbor pick it up.
We're always
waiting for somebody else to take that call to run the mission, to do what we see need to be done. But
I think back then they
want
to change that. Say what?
I said, my thing is, if you see it need to be done, it's your job. I'm saying, that's why I'm working on so many projects. I hate to. But when you come up with the idea, that's yours.
Yeah.
See, you know what, and I didn't mean to cut you off, Kerry. See, I go back to ownership. See, the thing is that I see things a lot differently, but I see them, I try to do my best to see them through the eyes of my creator, my savior, because some things it's not about, well, I'm only going to pick up that paper because Mr. AJ is looking at me. And I want to present that air of I do the right thing. I should do it because it's right to do, because I'm able to do it, and that I want to follow through with what it, and I want to be consistent about what I'm doing. But a lot of people, they want to own a title or a position to look good, sound good. But when it comes to the work, they're nowhere to be found.
Well, you know what? We've come into a generation, too, where everybody wants their photo op. So if the occasion is not going to have a camera, you know, with a crowd of people who's going to see them in 20 minutes, they're not interested. And people don't realize that in the civil rights movement, there was a lot of planning and strategizing and all of that that went on way before the marching ever happened. And I think today you don't have that where people are willing to invest their personal time. You know, unless somebody's talking about cutting somebody a check, people are just not showing up. You say every Monday night we're going to meet here until we figure out what we need to do, people are not going to keep coming. I mean, like Christopher said earlier, people aren't even willing to give up Walmart for a week. So we cannot expect...
You're Harry Belafonte. Harry Belafonte and... what's her name? And Lena Horne were some of the main backers of the movement because they had money. See, Lena Horne was blacklisted because she was an activist first, then an actor and a singer. So you saw later in her career, she was only doing the black movies. But before, she was the only black person that could walk through the front door of a lot of the big arenas and the big halls and walk to the stage and sing because she had that authority. But when they saw she was an activist too, she became like Michael Jackson and like O.J. Simpson understood later on that just because we like you don't mean you're not black.
See that? Listen, y'all, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Center Stage. I think I forgot where I was. I do need to tell y'all what y'all listening to. You know, I'm just acting like it's just me, AJ, and Christopher sitting in the living room talking about Dr. King. I'm sorry, y'all listen. Listen, tonight we are talking about Dr. King, the man, his legacy. And we're just kind of talking about the movement and what he meant to us, you know, as a leader and how we feel about, you know, his leadership. And we just feel like, I just feel like personally, I haven't seen another leader that has, I don't know, sacrificed as much, gave as much, actually show by example what to do, how to do, and when to do, as Dr. King did. That's just me. So tonight, we're just sitting down talking about some trivia about Dr. King, sharing some of his speeches, and also just kind of looking at some of the struggle. I mean, and I think a lot of times we're forgetting, y'all, the struggle goes on. I mean, it didn't stop. I mean, it's, if anything, it's worse. Sometimes I look at what Dr. King was about, and then I look at where we are today, and I'm thinking everything that he gave his life for, we're still fighting for today. All those rights that they were fighting for, I mean, you know, surely we can sit on the bus now and we can pick whichever seat we want to, but the struggle is bigger now than just the seat on the bus. You know, it's just basic.
They go to the back, Gary.
Say what? This is true. We got a right to sit wherever we want to, and we automatically all migrate to the back. That's crazy, but you're exactly right. We're still doing crazy stuff like that. But, you know, when you listen to that mountaintop speech, the end of it, he's talking about the fact about these rights of freedom of speech and some of the other rights that we're actually right now fighting for. Is that crazy? 50 years ago, he died for some of these same rights we're trying to have today. We're still fighting over today.
Well, but Gary, the thing is all those rights we were given were written in law, but they were written in amendments.
Right.
So now we have a Congress and a House that's trying to take back everything that they said, almost like it's the 40 acres and the mule they promised us.
Yeah. And but how do you take the Constitution and dissect it as is being done, and it's just what it is, y'all. If you ain't paying attention, you need to. I mean, the Constitution is just basically being dissected, and just, I mean, I think they're just breaking it into pieces and just deciding, okay, we can use that, we don't need that anymore, and who needs that, and just tossing stuff out like it's just nobody's business. And I'm trying to figure out, when are people going to wake up and realize those are rights that we're giving up if we don't fight back? And that's the crazy
America
part.
Back.
That's what?
It's called taking America back. You know, if you're saying we want to take America back, all, like it's bitches, a long way from the plantations of its birth.
Yeah.
But it hadn't. So they say taking America back because at the present there's a black man running America.
Yeah. And you know, we don't listen
or interpret what they're saying. We just take it as though they're saying, take America back. We want to go back to our civil liberties and all this, but they're taking all the civil liberties. They're, you know, taking, you know, trying to change all the laws, abortion, voting rights, make them stricter, almost like we still got to pay $5 to go, walk into place.
Mm-hmm. Right to bear arms and all. And the thing is, y'all, like I said on the previous show, you can sit down and think that it's somebody else's job to fight this battle and you're just going to stay safe in your home, you know, with your two-car garage and your cars and your toys, and you think, okay, none of this is going to get taken away. It's going to get taken away. And that's why Dr. King died. Right. Say what, Christopher?
I was going to say, in terms of what both of you all were saying, I mean, I like that verbiage because a lot of folks today, like, they will put a lot of time and energy into a rally, a protest, and so forth. But they don't look at what's the end result. Okay, you got some exposure. This happened. But is that going to change why, what the reason behind or the problem behind why you're there in the first place? Just to go someplace and picket and protest, and you don't have a plan with actually what needs to be done, and then how you can coordinate and strategize to get it done. What you're doing is basically kicking up some dust. It may be good in principle, but in practice and in terms of I think, actually getting change to happen, to me, change is more measurable when you deal with the law. And the early forerunners for the civil rights movement and then in the 60s and the 70s, I think what they were doing is that they were affecting public policy. See, when you start doing that, and we start getting back to some of the ways that are proven, when you can affect the leadership and putting full court pressure on them and knowing which laws need to be affected and even some parts of the Constitution that need to be ratified, I'm telling you, the Constitution only has been ratified when there's enough people that know how to walk that tightrope and demand it, but not just yell and hoop and holler, but put stuff in writing, put people in place to make it happen. And then I think there's more measurable progressiveness in terms of equality that will happen. But a lot of people that just go picket and protest, at the end of the day, if you don't get some policy or some laws changed, upheld, reviewed, people are not just going to honestly do the right thing and make it fair. You got to be that. We as a people have to be the honest broker. But nobody wants to do the work. Now, some people, to their defense, I think some people don't know what to do.
Yeah.
But then even when you get a quorum together and you say, hey, okay, we went over this, you straight, I walked you through this, we did a mock walkthrough, okay, this. And then when it comes time to do it, they know where to be found. And that's not everybody. AJ did have a point. There are organizations that are still functioning, that are still beating the drum, which and doing things where they're trying to do it in a unified front. But I think a lot of the masses of black America today, they're not beating that same drum that folks that 40 and 50 years ago were beating.
I agree.
We're using auto-tunes and fake beats.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have drums no more.
I think we let the you know how the candle was burning. I think somebody let the candle go out. I really do, and I think our fire is just gone for getting up and doing something for self. I think we have become, and I'm speaking of the African American community, y'all, because I'm speaking to myself, preaching to the choir. I think we have gotten to a point that we're so reactive. Everything we do is we're chasing problems. We're putting out fires, but we're never looking down the road and saying, you know what? they finna take our rights away. We better get them off the couch and start marching. You know, we are literally sitting and waiting for them to come and get them. I mean, seriously, then I guess we're going to start the revolution after they come get the rights. That's not the way you do it. I mean, when you see somebody trying to take something from you that belongs to you, I think being, you know, reactive is crazy once they're taken away. But I think that's what we're getting ready to do. It's hard to get it back. And I think by the time somebody takes a right that's taken away from you, that actually was a part of the Constitution, by the time they take your freedom of speech away or take your right to bear arms away, I think getting it back is going to be pure D hell. Because I think whoever is smart enough to put in place the process is going to make that happen has pretty much thought about what could happen once they take it from you. And so I'm just thinking, when I keep seeing how close we're getting to those rights being taken away, I'm thinking, you know what, we waiting on somebody to come save us like another Dr. King, and it's not happening. I think, I don't know if it was AJ or Christopher said earlier, everybody's got a role. Everybody's got something they need. Whatever you can do, you need to be doing it. If that's petition writing or rallying or organizing or doing something, phone, bank, do something. But to sit down and watch us go backwards from what this man died for is just crazy. I mean, that's just my opinion. It's just crazy.
Well, Carrie, I think you kind of said it best when you basically talked about, I know my pastor offers the scenario, you go to church on Sunday, you don't stay to hardly greet anybody after service. And before services is, you know, you don't even find out who's sick, who may need something. You running home, you eating your chicken, and then you hopping in the bed. Well, that becomes a rhetorical cycle. So that I'm not saying you should not have the level of comfort and the things that please you, but we can become so much where we want to be entertained and wined and dined, and we want to be selfish and self-centered and being selfless. That we don't even, you know, some people go a whole month and they don't do anything for nobody else.
That's true.
It may take you 10 minutes to go to your neighbor and just say, hi, how you doing, or to check on somebody or do something. I didn't say you have to do it every day, but some people, when you ask them about just doing something that's going to make a better tomorrow for somebody or doing something in the community, they look at you like, why would I want to spend the effort on that? So they don't get the value of not just always thinking about yourself.
I agree. I mean, because, you know, when you think about the marches that they did as far as the boycott and actually, like, I mean, those people probably had jobs clear across the city. Can you imagine signing on to, okay, I'm gonna not catch that bus until, you know, we get what we want. Can you imagine? And then a week turns into a month, and then a month turns into 6 months, and y'all still out there talking about we're not gonna get on that. Say what?
But see, and the key thing is the unity. Now everybody, by and large, but if you can get a big quorum of people that are willing to sign on. And you can educate people, and you can get people to get their mind and their heart and their commitment wrapped around it, just like when they want to go get their hair or their nails done, or they want to go buy a new jacket or some shoes. I mean, when they're committed to saving up the money for that, oh, ain't nothing going to stop them from that. That's something they really want to do. But when you also put it in perspective that I think it's a thing of showing, teaching, mentoring, people have just gotten so far away from the mark in terms of being their brother and sister's keeper that some people are just trifling in their own right. They don't even hardly respect their own selves, let alone anybody else. But I think we can continue to push towards a movement to get somewhat back to that.
And I hope that's the case. I hope that it's not something that really bad has to happen for us to wake up and say, whoa, you know, we got to get back to the boycotting and to the marching and rallying and coming together and meeting and strategizing. I hope it doesn't come to something bad happening before we realize that, though.
But Kelly, the first stages of even fathoming, even that being a possibility or being probable, is what we're doing right now. Because you have a lot of blog talk shows, you have a lot of radio shows on Fishbowl, on all these other things. But the thing is, you don't have a lot of common people being able to communicate.
Yeah.
Because everybody thinks they know the facts because they have a smartphone and can access Google. But anytime you Google anything, there's 1,001 answers to whatever question you ask, so you can pick the answer that fits you best.
That's true.
That doesn't mean that you have the right answer. That just means that you have something in the vein of what you thought. So until we actually become a people that's willing to listen every now and then and set back and garner some information from some other intelligent beings and say that, oh, I agree with you, and, yeah, well, let me add this to my vocabulary, or let me add this to my steps, or add this to my process, and then we become a unit as a whole, it's hard to come and march when you got all these people with different communication skills and different conversations and not willing to talk to each other.
And you know what, and I heard T.D. Jakes preach this message, I don't know if it was recently, but it was just one of his messages. I can't say if it was recent or not. But I came across it the other day, and he said something that was so profound. He was talking about it escapes me, God, I cannot believe it escapes me. Who was it that God sent to Nineveh? Remember when God sent someone? Who was that he sent? Was it Jonah that he sent? It wasn't Jonah that he sent to Nineveh.
Jonah.
Was it Jonah that he sent?
Jonah.
He sent Jonah to Nineveh, and Jonah didn't want to go. Jonah was like, listen, I don't want to go. Listen, I'm going to go somewhere else because I don't want to do that. And God kept urging him to do it, and, of course, he had to persuade him by sending him through the fish to do whatever it was that he requested him to do, which is go to preach to Nineveh and tell them that the God would destroy the city. But he said something so profound in that message, and that was that Jonah went and delivered the message that God had given him for Nineveh. And basically, Jonah expected the city was going to be destroyed. And God said, in 40 days, I'm going to destroy the city. And the one thing that stopped it was that the people of Nineveh began to pray. And I think that's where we forget that the Bible still says, if my people, which are called by my name, would humble themselves and pray and seek my face, then we can see a change. And I think that's the one weapon of mass destruction that we're failing to use right now. Back then, those people prayed a lot during that civil rights movement, too. You know, they weren't just meeting in the church. They was praying, too.
Yeah.
You know.
And you know what? And the thing that I think is maybe parallel but similar in the case of Jonah and the Ninevites is a lot of people – they may not understand the reason why Jonah didn't want to go. Jonah didn't want to go because the Ninevites were they had a strong army, they had a lot of money, and they tend to kill, pillage, and oppress people just because. So Jonah's people had the beat down for hundreds of years by the Ninevites. So when it came time that he thought God had the audacity to ask him to go to a city that had been oppressing his people for many hundreds of years. But like you said, in terms of continuing on with with the scripture, I mean, Jonah finally got to the point, because even though he went to Nineveh, he still didn't have a, God, this is what you want me to do, I'm going to go do it. He still had a little bit of that, I'm doing it, but I don't like it.
But you left out the most important part. Jonah got on the boat to go somewhere else.
Yes.
Well, the people on the boat said, this storm is only here because of you.
But he did that because he was so enraged that God would actually want him to go to – but you're right. That's the thing about it.
But I'm saying it was the other people's action. It was the other people's action that made him go to Nineveh because they threw him off the boat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes you're forced in a position that you didn't want to be in, that you're supposed to be in.
True.
That's the message.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes you don't want to do what it is that you got to do, so if that's the only, all the other roads are closed, then you say, oh, well, here we go. you know, kind of like Lethal Weapon 4, I think it was Lethal Weapon 4, the last scene, where the guy, where Jet Li had taken their gun apart, and they were saying, they knew they had to arrest him, but he had already beat him up pretty bad. He said, well, I still want to know how he took my gun apart. He said, oh, well, I guess we'll go at it.
But, you know, to me, that is a good lesson, and the Bible is chalked of good lessons where we do not have to go down that same road, because someone has already been down that road, but like clockwork. We go down the same road that Jonah does, like you're saying, where we should do, we don't want to do, we try and bypass, go around. But when it comes down to it, you may pass that piece of paper up that you were referring to today. You may pass it up tomorrow. Now, the next day is to be there. Hopefully, at some point, you will have some ownership and you will do something. And then maybe if you get tired of picking up that piece of paper, maybe you'll then take some action, talk to your neighbors, print up flyers and say, hey, this is our community. How about I do this on this day? So now you have a plan, you strategize what you're going to do, and then you can delegate things where it's now no longer one person's responsibility and you can hold each other accountable, like on this show. I mean, we're like to one another the honest brokers. We hold each other accountable. But in the same token, we're a family.
Mm-hmm.
And
we are.
Try and work towards, you know, what's going to be in the best interest of what we're talking about. And then after we're done talking, we don't run home and grab a bucket of chicken and eat it and hop into bed, and then we just come back the next time. We're all in our individual collective lives. We're doing things to put forth in our small way to try and make a change, which is action.
And we are, and I agree. So you know what? I love these guys so much, y'all just don't know. Because I think when we do these shows, we're just doing shows every week. We're doing shows that we feel will help the listening audience, and they help us every week. We learn something every week in our research and in doing these shows, and we do shows that we feel we just don't pick shows. We walked away from a show last week. We don't just pick shows. It's got to be right. It's got to feel right. It's got to be right in terms of the guest has got to be coming and being truthful. And so we don't just do shows. And so we are a family here on Center Stage, and we do try to bring the best shows to be informative and both informative and entertaining. Y'all agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, y'all. Listen, we still got some trivia to get to and some other facts about Dr. King. As a matter of fact, the fact that he won several awards. I mean, this man was so accomplished for his short life. Awards, y'all, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. He won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He also won the Congressional Gold Medal. And he also won Time's Person of the Year. I mean, really, he just did so much, you know, that he packed into his small life. He won a Grammy in 1971 and was awarded, he won a Grammy in 1971, and the Grammy was for the Best Spoken Word Album for Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam. Now, go figure. I didn't know that. I never knew he won a Grammy. I didn't know there was a category. Did y'all know there was a category for that?
No. For his for the oration part of it?
I guess so, because it says for the best spoken word. He actually did an album about why I opposed the war in Vietnam. So I didn't know that. You know, this guy was just so it was great researching for this show, because it was just so many things that he did that I wasn't even aware of just how accomplished he was.
But Cherry, one thing I want to add to that is that we're looking at all his accomplishments and what he did. But if you notice, everything was noted. He left prints and markers and albums and books. So the thing is, what are we doing that's going to let people know that we were here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he does, you know what, you are right, AJ, in researching for this show, he does make you feel like, wow, I got some work to do, you know, because I really want to leave this world a better place, and I think when I leave here, I want to leave here with somebody saying, Carrie did some good, you know what I'm saying? So I think we all have that responsibility. I do. I think we all have the responsibility to not just occupy space, but our footprint that we leave here, or it should be one where somebody can say they did some good while they were here.
Yeah.
That's just me. Yeah. Yeah. So far, and sizing up to Dr. King, and I know we shouldn't try to be like anybody else, but he makes you want to be better.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, he makes me want to be better. He makes me want to do some things. But one thing I found in researching for this show, too, is that Dr. King's autopsy revealed that stress had taken a major toll on his body. Despite being 39 at the time of his death, the doctors noted that his heart was like that of a 60-year-old.
Yeah, I'm sure that he had what's called cardiomegaly. And oftentimes black individuals, because when you think about levels of stress and anxiety, and then also the all those emotional things, being on the road, probably halfway eating right, lack of sleep, all those things. And then he did that on a regular basis because he was known to stay up late reading, studying, and investigating things. So, and away from home a lot. So that's probably very traumatic on the body. So, based on that autopsy, they probably found a lot of things that were like, how old was he? So
39 when he died.
Wow. Yeah.
Heart of a 60-year-old. And, you know, the thing is, and I think I took one thing away from his speech. And you know, the Bible, and someone quoted this recently, and I don't remember who it was, how many times God speaks of fear in the Bible. Fear is not of God. And man can only kill the body one time. And so I am of the belief, walk away from that speech, that I will fear no man. Okay? Because greater is he that's in me than he that's in the world. And so whatever happens, you can only kill the body.
Sure. All these things we're talking about recently, I just, you know, because for the last week, you know, I was trying not to log on Facebook and try not to stay on any of the meetings because I've been working on this book. I was going through some things. So I'm like, let me fix me.
Mm.
So instead of, you know, everything I post on Facebook is positive. But I wrote this like a one-minute poem that I wrote for me.
Mm-hmm.
And me, when I'm going through things, I think my outlet is this, because I know stress is not, you know, people don't have all the things they have until they have stress, and then stress cannot heal your body.
Mm.
I mean, if the problem can't heal your body because stress, your body's trying to fight off stress, but there's nothing to fight, so you don't have the antibodies to fight off whatever that stuff is coming next.
I agree.
But I'm just going to share this with you right quick. It's like a one-minute poem.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, it says, I never thought I'd get here. It wasn't where I was heading. There are times the lesson is how tight you keep your lips, while others' throats are jingling, tongue loose and mouth wide. It's a struggle gathering the courage to keep moving and the patience to stay quiet. It only matters what you do, not say. Failing is a rough pill to swallow, even if it's your turn or maybe the doctor ordered it. I'm at the preface of a void between everywhere and nothing. Wasn't searching for peace, just the pieces of me lost in the center of someone else's chest. I write with a loving hand holding the evilest pen. It's hard to hush the screams and thoughts of demons. I am the hidden wish in the words of a prayer. The speck of truth lodged in lying teeth. A witless suicide whispered as murder. A darkened cavity mistaken for a sweet tooth. Words can only damage what others think of you, but it leaves your character intact. Refute must be an instrument I haven't learned to play. I'm at fear on my way here. The only thing I'm afraid of is giving up.
Mm, ouch. Love that. Absolutely.
Wow.
Love that. I love that, AJ.
Enjoyed that.
And guess who's on the phone line, y'all? Who I call the poet of history. I see Brother Hurd on the line. Is that Ronald Hurd on the line, I see?
Yeah, Sister Carrie, how you doing? I know how to call in tonight.
Good evening, Ron. You know, he did a show with me, y'all, one time about a real black history lesson. This brother is deep with history, especially black
Amen.
History.
Amen.
Hey, Leslie, yes. I mean, wow. Good evening, Ronald. How you doing?
I'm good. I can't complain. How y'all doing today? Or tonight, rather.
We on your tonight.
I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry.
You know we on your subject tonight.
Oh, yeah. You know, I had to call in. I make sure I was running late to calling in, but I make sure I called in. I know y'all covered a lot of ground because y'all, this is a very informative show. I think that's Brother Bonds on there. Is Brother Bonds on here as well?
Yes, sir. How you doing, Brother Ron?
It was good to meet you, man. I really enjoyed it. We was at ground zero, so to speak, talking about Dr. King. And I'm glad you pointed out about Dr. King, about, you know, his health after, you know, they did the autopsy, because that's very important to know that this man was under continued stress by the last 13 years of his life. There was a story of Walter Funchroy, who was the former secretary of the SCLC. When they went to President Kennedy's funeral in Washington, D.C. back in 63, Dr. King was at a building looking down at the funeral procession. And he told Walter Funchroy, if they could do that to a president, I won't make it to 40.
Whoa.
And so he died when he was 39. That's the same age that Malcolm died. It's a different thing that people should note. A lot of our greatest black leaders, especially in America, have met their end during their 30s. Like, you look at Medgar Evers, was 37 when he died. After Kennedy did that speech, he got shot in front of his family at his home in Jackson, Mississippi. Then Dr. King and Malcolm were both 39 when they passed. And something about the 30s is a very interesting time, because people don't understand that when you have social justice movements and revolutions, you need intergenerational cooperation. There's something about especially a black male in their 30s, where you're not too young or not too old, but you're being able to act as some type of bridge between generations. Like with Marcus Garvey. When they started messing with Marcus Garvey, when the government took him down, he was about 37 years old when he went to jail for mail fraud. So there's a pattern. Even looking at Africa, look at Steve Biko, look at Patrice Lumumba. Steve Biko was barely 30-something years old when he got killed, and Patrice Lumumba was in his 30s. And you look at what happened to those countries. So I'm saying there's something about a black male. So they try to get you. I mean, you think about like Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was under FBI surveillance since he was 14, 15 years old, growing up in Maywood, Illinois, because he grew the NAACP youth membership. Imagine if you're a young black boy who's 14 years old, and you're able to grow a membership of the NAACP Youth Council to hundreds of members. He was able to integrate the Maywood, Illinois public swimming pool because of the numbers he was able to grow from that one group. Well, think about an out in L.A. where you had Black Panther Party member Bunchy Carter, who was the leader of the Black Panthers of L.A., who was a gang member. He was in the Flossers. He had 5,000 young black youths ready to do battle. And they killed him in UCLA.
Wow.
He was just 26 years old. Look up Bunchy Carter. Look up all these people. So I'm saying Fred Hampton was 21. He was under surveillance since he was 14. And Dr. King was what? Just about going to Morehouse around, what, 15? And Dr. Dorsey, I remember having dinner with Dr. King when he was like 15 or 16 years old, visiting Dr. Benjamin E. May at his home.
Oh.
Wow.
Tell us this, because you're from Memphis. And I got to pull it up right now. Tell us about Billy Kyle and the fact that Billy Kyle said moved. Let's go there with me.
Okay, go ahead. I'm listening. Yes. Well, I'll tell you one thing. Back in 1999, there was a civil trial that was brought up by Dr. William Pepper. Dr. William Pepper is an interesting guy. He was the lawyer for James Earl Ray. People don't even understand James Earl Ray never had a proper trial for the killing of Dr. King. He never had a proper trial. He made some type of plea to protect his family because his first lawyer was Percy Foreman. He was a mob lawyer from Dallas. So let's know what time it was. And, you know, people always tell me what James Earl Ray did, but think about this. If you escape from a federal penitentiary in the heartland, he escaped from a federal penitentiary in Missouri. He was on the run for almost 3 years, and yet he ended up in Heathrow Airport in London with a passport. So I guess he acted alone, huh?
True.
No, he didn't act at all. He was a passenger. But getting back to Billy Cowles, that was a civil trial. In Memphis back in 1999, that was sponsored and endorsed by the King family. The jury found the U.S. government guilty of killing Dr. King.
Yeah.
And I talked to former police officers and whatnot, because there was a rumor going around that Reverend Billy Cowles was a Memphis police informant. As a matter of fact, somebody said that Billy Cowles told the police officers that they could stand a block away from the Lorraine Motel when Dr. King was shot. And Billy Cowles, like, you know, he got on a couple of TV shows, and he did the documentary, Witness to Room 306, about Dr. King, that, you know, got nominated for an Oscar. If you read Ralph Abernathy's book, his controversial book about his relationship with Dr. King and the movement, Dr. King allegedly was, in the last hour of his life, he was not meeting with Billy Cowles and Ralph Abernathy in Room 306. He was in an SCLC meeting. His brother, A.E. King, was in town. He was in a meeting with his lieutenants, like Hosea Williams and Dr. James Horn. So he was in a meeting the last hour of his life. And also, people don't understand. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Kyle's is just, I don't know, and y'all, it's a two-minute clip I'm going to let y'all hear in a minute where you will hear
ahead,
him. And please listen very closely. He says in the clip, I moved because I, didn't he say something like, I moved because I didn't want to, I didn't want to get shot or something like
that?
Well,
he got a better shot, right, something like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they could get a better shot. This is Billy Kyle's, a very prominent minister in Memphis. Here we go.
Stop in a hotel, but when you think about marching from Memphis to Jackson or Jackson to Memphis, that was a hotel. You stayed in churches, you stayed in people's homes, and that's how we got over. That's how we got through. The struggle was a spiritual struggle. You couldn't pay people to do what we had to do. You couldn't pay people to stand before mad dogs and fire hoses and billy clubs and cattle prods. It was strictly a spiritual and moral movement. So we wanted that dimension to be in the pilgrimage to Memphis. We will revisit the mountaintop speech site. That's the Mason's Temple, where Dr. King made his last address, which he almost didn't make, because the night that we were having that rally, there were tornado warnings, and he was behind on the Poor People's Campaign. And he said, you guys go on over and have the rally. I'm going to stay at the motel and work on the Poor People's Campaign. When we got there and Dr. Abernathy walked in and Jesse Jackson walked in and I walked in and others, people started clapping because they thought Martin was behind us. And so Ralph Preacher sent, said to him, this is not our crowd. And he went to the phone and called Dr. King. And any of the marches that we had in those days, you have an opportunity to bring the children and bring the family and march with us. And when I finished sharing with them the last hour of Dr. King's life, a hurry. But that gave me the wonderful privilege of spending the last hour on earth. Three preachers in a room, Abernathy, King, and Kyle. And we spent that last hour together in room 306 at the Lorraine Motel. The press is always curious and writers.
Several times in different interviews. I know one interview, Reverend James Orange was present. I think that was in Jackson, Mississippi. And when Reverend James Orange, one of Dr. King's lieutenant, heard him say that, he wanted to kill Reverend Cowles for saying that.
I don't know if it's his conscious is speaking out when he, I don't know, maybe he's on medication, I don't know, but he clearly said, I moved away. You know,
so he said
I
that many
my...
times before, though. That's the thing. It's many different versions of that, when he says that.
Well, has anybody asked him the question directly, moved away, so who could get a clear shot? I mean, did you have some prior knowledge that a shot was going to be taken? Has anybody asked him that point blank?
He was cross-examined. You can find the full transcript for the 1999 civil trial on the King Center website now. They took it down for a couple of years, I guess, but you can find it right now. I would suggest that everybody download the full transcript, because it was a sister that was a lawyer. If you read William Pepper's An Act of State about the trial, a woman lawyer, a sister lawyer, cross-examined Billy Cowles on the stand, and he failed. The King family did not trust Billy Cowles or Jesse Jackson. They had a SCLC conference in 2003 where Coretta Scott King and her family, along with the great Steve Coakley, the late great Steve Coakley, the great researcher, came down to Memphis, and the final call had a newspaper article that talked about Billy Cowles and Jesse Jackson being part of the King assassination. Billy Cowles is from Chicago. Jesse is stationed in Chicago. We all know about Chicago. It's a gangster town. Like, you know what I'm talking about. With either Harold Washington. So they took the final call, printed that story, and they had to take it back because Jesse and Billy Cowles, they got a lot of powerful Chicago connections. And they forced them to retract it, and they fired the editor.
They were talking about if you could maybe speak to the individuals that actually said that they were with Dr. King at last hour versus the ones who were actually there. And then Jesse Jackson also lied. I don't know if he was ever interviewed or if he was basically cross-examined in court. But Jesse Jackson said he was the one that actually was there when the shot rang out and that he was the one that held Dr. King and put the towel on his head.
I understand that
was the furthest thing from the truth because Jesse Jackson was down on the first floor talking to somebody else when that happened. And he ran up there after the fact.
That's right.
Wow. And you know what? And speaking of that, y'all, the day that the King was shot, a little known fact that I did not know until we did the research for this show is that King was not the only one that died that day. Allegedly, Lorraine Bailey, who was the wife of the owner of the Lorraine Motel, was the switchboard operator as well. And she had gone into the courtyard for whatever reason to look at Dr. King. I don't know what he was doing because they said he was there smoking a cigarette. So I'm not sure why she was just there looking at Dr. King. But that's when the shot took place. And she saw this. She had a heart attack. And allegedly, Billy Cowles was saying that's when he went to, after the shot took place, he went to the place where the switchboard operator normally would be to tell them to call the ambulance, and nobody was there. So allegedly, that's why it took the ambulance so long to get there. But Lorraine Bailey later died from that heart attack. I never knew that.
I'll say this real quick, too, with that incident. And the wife, apparently, Reverend Billy Cowles said that he also went up at the time after the shot rang out, and he took the cigarette out of Dr. King's hand because he didn't want the public to have that identity of him smoking. But the thing was is that he was already out there on the balcony allegedly smoking, so there were reporters down below. So what is he talking about? They had saw him come out with it in his hand, so there would have been no reason for him to get it out of his hand for whatever PR reason.
I also like to say, Walter Bailey, who owned the Hotel Lorraine at the time, he had Dr. King in a secluded area. He was not supposed to be on that balcony. Somebody from his entourage changed the room to 306 to that balcony room, because what people don't understand, too, is that when Dr. King used to come into Memphis, he would stay at the Holiday Inn or somewhere like that. It was a white-owned hotel. He didn't stay at the Lorraine Hotel. And then the news people actually broadcast his room number on the news. They said, well, Dr. King is staying at room 306 at the Lorraine Motel. So they got clips of that, actually, of them broadcasting that. And also, I talked to Reverend C.T. Vivian, one of the MLK's lieutenants, because, you know, the Ernest Witter thing came out about the photographer being a quote-unquote informant. There was Dr. King's itinerary secretary. His name was James or Jim Harrison. He was his itinerary secretary at the SCLC. He was responsible for where Dr. King was going to be at any given moment. So he was an FBI agent / informant, whatever you want to call him. He actually met with the FBI the day that Dr. King was killed. So this is a guy that was responsible for where Dr. King would be at any given moment. So that's something
you
didn't know.
No, a lot of people don't know. Also, Ronald, if you would run down real quick the fact that that wasn't the first assassination attempt on Dr. King's life. Wasn't he previously stabbed by a lady?
A quote-unquote deranged lady in Harlem. If he had got a little bit close to his heart, he would have died. If he had sneezed, he would have died. He stabbed him with a comb, not mistaken. It was like when he was doing a book sign after the Montgomery bus boycott.
Yes. I mean, so God has spared his life because I, you know, like he said, the doctor told him, if you, in all that time that we were doing all this surgery, if you had sneezed, or I guess any time from the time that she stabbed him until the time that they finished the surgery.
Yeah, he would have bled himself.
Could have bled. He would have drowned in his own blood. That's
blood.
Just how
they would have stabbed his heart. You know, one of his. You know. Yeah.
That's crazy. And so, you know, tonight, y'all, we've just tried to give you a glimpse into who we found Dr. King to be. And in my opinion, he was an amazing man who died way too soon, fighting a cause that, you know, the struggle goes on even today. And so, you know, it was just a great show. I really enjoyed hanging out with you guys, Christopher Buns, AJ Houston. Thank you, Ronald Hurd, for stopping by. I hope everybody learned something tonight, because I definitely learned something in the research of this show. So many different things that you don't normally hear when people talk about Dr. King. You know, it's really pretty much the same thing, a speech here and a couple of facts that they repeat every single time that people talk about him. But tonight we tried to do something a little different. Also, y'all, a reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or advertisers. And also a reminder, this Friday night we're back again. That's the 24th. We're going to be talking about mental illness in the Black community. That's something we have not touched before, but we're going to go there Friday night, and we're going to have a study group out of Dallas that's going to be joining us to talk about that. Mental illness in the Black community is what we're going to talking about this coming Friday night, January 24th. Also, y'all, drop us a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Tell us what y'all think of the show. Listen, if y'all hate us, tell us that. If you love what we're doing, tell us that. If you have a show idea that you'd like to see us do, we'd love to hear from you. Again, centerstageradio@yahoo.com. We also ask you to tell a friend, tell a neighbor, tell a coworker about the show, and check us out every Friday night, 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern. We're right here, Center Stage, doing it. And so we have some great shows lined up. Coming up, another show that we've already booked and we want you to chime in on, Lindsey Williams is going to be back with us, y'all, February 7th. He's already booked with us. He's going to be bringing Dr. Rodriguez from the BioCare Hospital in I think Mexico. Is that Tijuana, Mexico? But they're going to be with us on the 7th, talking about alternatives to issues like cancer, diabetes, medical treatments that may be a little different from what your doctor may be treating you here. Dr. Rodriguez has a wonderful hospital over there, and he's just going to tell us a little bit about what they're doing, and it may be something that you want to check out. So they're going to be with us, Lindsey Williams and Dr. Rodriguez, back on February 7th to tell us what's going on at BioCare Hospital in Mexico. Okay, y'all, listen, we're going to get out of here, but we enjoyed breaking down what we learned in research about Dr. King this week. And, you know, I enjoyed my holiday today. I hope everybody else did too. And so tonight we're going to leave out with one of my favorite songs. And we're going to, I love Crystal Aiken, and so we're going to play some Crystal Aiken as we get out of here tonight. But, again, please drop us a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Tell us what you think of the show. And if you have any show ideas that you'd like to see us do, we definitely like to do it. I'm sorry, I don't want to do Crystal Aiken's right now, even though I love her to death. I'm going to go out on the song, I'm In His Safety. See you guys next week. Bye-bye.
He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High God shall abide in His grace. He that walketh through the valley of death shall in no wise be entangled. By God's hand you shall be kept. So if I go into the heavens, He knows. If I go into the deepest depths, He knows. So no matter what may come my way, I'm covered by His blood. even when Satan seems to rage from its hand, I'm hidden safe. I'm in his safety, dwell in his safety. The safety of the Lord, nothing can stop me. Devil, you should have killed me while you had the chance. You don't even harm me. I'm in the safety. I'm in the safety of the Lord. I'm I dwell in the safety, the safety. Bless your name, oh God. I rest in, yes, I do, the safety of the arresting him.